She bent backward, taking the wire in her hands, and flipped her stance so that she was facing her opponent. The girl's wrist snapped out again. Inej felt another bright stab of pain, and when she looked down, she saw a spiked metal star protruding from her thigh. From somewhere below, she heard shouting, the sounds of a fight. Nina. Who or what had Jan Van Eck sent after her? But she could not afford distraction, not on the wire, not faced with this creature. "I hear you hoard for the peacock," Dunyasha said, as she flung another spiked star at Inej, and another. Inej avoided both, but took the next in the meat of her right shoulder. She was bleeding badly. "I would have killed myself and everyone beneath that roof before letting myself be used in such a way." "You're being used now," Inej replied. "Van Eck isn't worthy of your skill." "If you must know, Pekka Rollins pays my wages," said the girl, and Inej's footsteps faltered. "Rollins? He pays for my travel, my lodgings, but I ask no money for the lives I take. They are the jewels I wear. They are my glory in this world and will bring me honor in the next." Pekka Rollins. Had he somehow found Kaz? The others? What if Nina was lying dead below? Inej had to get free of this girl. She had to help them. Another silver star came whirring at her, and she bent left to avoid it, almost lost her balance. She danced backward on the wire, glimpsed another glint of silver. Pain lanced through her arm, and she hissed in a breath. "Our work is death, and it is holy." What dark god did this mercenary serve? Inej imagined some vast deity looming above the city, faceless and featureless, skin taut over its swollen limbs, fattened on the blood of its acolyte's victims. She could feel its presence, the chill of its shadow. A star lodged in Inej's shin, another in her forearm. She glanced over her shoulder. Only 10 more feet and she would be at the first silo. Dunyasha might know more about fighting than Inej ever would, but she didn't know Ketterdam. Inej would race to the bottom of the silo, find Nina. They'd lose this monster in the streets and canals Inej knew so well. Again, she gauged the distance behind her. Just a few more feet. But when she looked back, Dunyasha was no longer on the wire. Inej saw her bend, saw her hand reach for the magnet. "No. Protect me," she whispered to her saints. The line went slack. Inej fell, twisting in the air the way she had as a child, searching for her wings.
21. Kaz. Kaz heard a roaring in his ears. As always, he experienced a strange kind of doubling when he looked at Rollins, as if he'd been up too late and had far too much to drink. The man before him was Pekka Rollins, King of the Barrel, Ganglord, and Impresario. But he was also Jacob Hertzun, the supposedly upstanding merch who had fed Kaz and Geordi on comfort and confidence, then taken their money and left them helpless in a city that put no value on mercy. Any sign of the respectable Jacob Hertzun was gone tonight. Rollins wore a green-striped waistcoat, snugly buttoned over the beginnings of a gut, and trousers with an emerald sheen. Apparently, he'd replaced the watch Kaz had stolen from him, because he took out a new one and glanced at it now. "This thing never keeps time quite right," Rollins said, giving the watch a shake, his sideburns quivering slightly as he breathed an exasperated sigh. "But I can't resist a fine bit of shine." "Don't suppose you kept the one you took off me?" Kaz said nothing. "Well," Rollins continued with a shrug, snapping the watch shut and returning it to his waistcoat pocket. "Right about now, my lieutenant should be rounding up your crew and a certain priceless hostage at Black Veil Island." Weilin released a distressed sound. "I've also prepared something special for the Wraith," said Rollins. "An extraordinary asset, that girl. I didn't like the thought of that particular arrow in your quiver, so I found someone even more extraordinary to take care of her." A quick sensation settled in Kaz's stomach. He thought of Inej rolling her shoulders, the tidy frame of her body brimming with confidence. "I don't work with the net." "Did you really think you'd be that hard to find, Brecker?" I've been at this game a long time. All I had to do was think what I'd have done when I was younger and more foolish. The roaring in Kaz's ears grew louder. You're working for Van Eck. He'd known it was a possibility, but he'd ignored it. He'd thought that if he moved fast enough, they wouldn't have time to form an alliance. I'm working with Van Eck. After you came to me looking for cash, I had a feeling he might have need of my services. He was hesitant at first. Hasn't had the best luck making deals with barrel boys. But that little stunt you pulled with his wife drove him right into my loving arms. I told Van Eck you'd always be a step ahead of him because he can't help thinking like a businessman. Kaz nearly flinched. Hadn't he had the very same thought? He's a savvy one, no doubt, continued Rollins. But a man of limited imagination. Whereas you, Brecker, think like a villainous little thug. You're me with a lot more hair and a lot less style. Van Eck thought he had you all tied up on West Stave. Felt pretty good about calling in the stud watch, too. But I knew you'd be more slippery than that. And you knew I'd come here? Rollins chuckled. I knew you couldn't resist it. Oh, I didn't know what plan you'd concoct, but I knew whatever scheme you devised would bring you here. You couldn't pass up the chance to humiliate Van Eck. To take back what you think he owes you. The deal is the deal. Rollins shook his head, clucking like a big mother hen. You take things too personally, Brecker. You should be focused on the job, but you're too busy holding a grudge. That's where you're wrong, said Kaz. I don't hold a grudge. I cradle it. I coddle it. I feed it fine cuts of meat and send it to the best schools. I nurture my grudges, Rollins.
I'm glad you've kept your sense of humor, lad. Once you've served your term in Stir, assuming Van Eck lets you live, I might just let you come work for me. Shame to see a talent like yours go to waste.
I'd rather be cooked slow on a spit with Van Eck turning the handle. Rollins' smile was magnanimous.
I imagine that can be arranged, too. I'm nothing if not accommodating.
Just keep talking, Kaz urged silently, his hand slipping inside Weiland's satchel. What makes you think Van Eck will honor his agreement with you any more than he did with us? Because I have the sense to get cash up front. And my demands are decidedly more moderate. A few million Kruger to rid the barrel of a nuisance I'd like to see gone anyway?
Most reasonable.
Rollins hooked his thumbs into his waistcoat. Fact is, Van Eck and I understand each other. I'm expanding. Growing my territory, thinking bigger. The Kalish Prince is the finest establishment East Save has ever seen, and it's only the beginning. Van Eck and I are builders. We want to create something that outlasts us. You'll grow into it, boy. Now hand over that seal and come quietly, why don't you? Kaz pulled the seal from his pocket, held it up, letting it catch the lamplight, drawing Pekka's gaze. He hesitated. Come now, Brecker. You're tough, I confess. But I've got you cornered and outnumbered. You can't make the drop from that window, and Van Eck has stud watch lining the street below. You're done for. Toasted, swinging in the wind. So don't do anything foolish. But if you couldn't open a door, you just had to make a new one. Rollins was easy to get talking. In fact, Kaz doubted he could stop him if he wanted to. Then it was just a question of keeping Rollins' eyes on the shiny golden seal in Kaz's right hand while he opened the jar of auric acid with the left. Get ready, he murmured. Kaz, Weiland protested. Kaz tossed the seal to Rollins and in the same motion splashed the remaining acid onto the floor. The room filled with heat, and the carpet hissed as a plume of acrid smoke rose from it.
Stop them! Rollins shouted.
See you on the other side, said Kaz. He grabbed his cane and smashed it into the boards beneath their feet. The floor gave way with a groan. They crashed through to the first floor in a cloud of plaster and dust, right onto a dinner table that collapsed beneath their weight. Candlesticks and dishes went rolling. Kaz sprang to his feet, cane in hand, gravy dripping from his coat, then hauled Weiland up beside him. He had a brief moment to register the startled expressions of the merchers around the table, their mouths wide with shock, napkins still in their laps. Then Van Eck was screaming, "Seize them!" And Kaz and Weiland were leaping over a fallen ham and sprinting down the black-and-white tiled hall. Two liveried guards stepped in front of the glass-paneled doors that opened onto the back garden, lifting their rifles. Kaz put on a spurt of speed and dropped into a slide. He braced his cane horizontally across his chest and shot between the guards, letting the cane bash into their shins, knocking them from their feet. Weiland trailed after him, tumbling down the stairs into the garden. Then they were at the boathouse, over the railing, and into the gondola Roddy had kept waiting in the canal. A bullet pinged into the side of the boat as gunfire peppered the water around them. He and Roddy seized their oars. "Drop heavy!" Kaz shouted, and Weiland let loose with every rocket, flash bomb, and bit of demo he'd been able to fit into the boat. The sky above the Van Eck house exploded in an array of light, smoke, and sound as the guards dove for cover. Kaz put his arms to work, feeling the boat slide into the current as they passed into the glittering traffic of the Geld Canal.
"In and out without him ever knowing?" said Roddy.
"I was half right," growled Kaz. "We have to warn the others," Weiland gasped.
"Rollins said Pekka Rollins was there?"
Roddy asked, and Kaz heard the fear in his voice. A canal rat would take on 1,000 thugs and thieves, merchers and mercenaries, but not Pekka Rollins. Kaz tipped one of his oars, steering the boat starboard and barely missing a brow boat full of tourists.
"We have to go back to Black Veil. The others..." "Shut up, Weiland. I need to think."
Jesper and Matthias were both good in a fight. If anyone had a chance of getting Kuei off Black Veil, they did. But how had Pekka found them? Someone must have been followed to the island. They'd all taken risks that day, ventured away from Black Veil. Any one of them might have been spotted and pursued. Nina and Matthias, Weiland and Jesper, Kaz himself. Once Pekka had located their hideout, he would have kept them under surveillance every minute, just waiting for them to separate and make themselves vulnerable. Kaz flexed his shoulders, and Roddy matched his pace, the strokes of their oars driving the boat forward faster through the current. He needed to get them into traffic, and as far away from Van Eck's house as possible. He needed to get to Sweet Reef. Rollins's men would have followed Inej and Nina there from Black Veil. Why had he sent them to the silos alone? Nina and her precious refugees, there would be no grand rescue for the Grisha tonight. All their chances were shot to hell. "I've also prepared something special for the Wraith. To hell with revenge. To hell with his schemes. If Rollins had done something to Inej, Kaz would paint East Stave with his entrails. Think. When one plan was blown, you made a new one. When they backed you into a corner, you cut a hole in the roof." But he couldn't fix something he couldn't catch hold of. The plan had gone slippery. He'd failed them. He'd failed her. All because he seemed to have some kind of blind spot where Pekka Rollins was concerned. Jesper could be dead already. Inej could be bleeding on the streets of Sweet Reef. He turned his oars. "We're going to the warehouse district." "What about the others?" "Jesper and Matthias are fighters, and there's no way Pekka's going to risk harming Kuei. We're going to Sweet Reef."
"You said we'd be safe on Black Veil," Weiland protested. "You said
there is no safe," Kaz snarled. "Not in the barrel, not anywhere." He threw his strength into rowing. "No seal, no ship. Their money spent. What do we do now?" Weiland said quietly, his voice barely audible above the sound of the water and the other boats on the canal. "Pick up a pair of oars and make yourself useful," said Kaz. "Or I'll put your pampered ass in the drink and let your father fish you out."
22. Nina. Nina heard them before she saw them. She was positioned between the second and third silos, where she could watch Inej's progress and keep an eye on the guardhouse. Inej had climbed the silo like a tiny, nimble spider, moving at a pace that made Nina tired just watching her. The angle was steep enough that she could barely see Inej once she'd reached the top, so Nina couldn't tell what progress she was making with the hatch. But Inej didn't start crossing when Nina gave the first signal, so she must have had some delay with the lines or with the weevil. At the second signal, Nina saw her step out over nothing. From where Nina waited, the high wire was invisible in the dark, and it looked as if Inej was levitating, each step precise, considered. There, the faintest wobble. Now, a small correction. Nina's heart beat a skittering rhythm as she watched. She had the absurd feeling that if she let her own focus waver for even a second, Inej might fall, as if Nina's concentration and faith were helping keep her aloft. When Inej finally reached the second silo, Nina wanted to cheer. But she settled for a brief silent dance. Then she waited for the guards to come back into view on the western side of the perimeter. They stopped at the guardhouse for a few minutes and set out again. Nina was about to signal Inej when she heard the sound of rowdy laughter. The guards noticed too, suddenly alert. Nina saw one of them ignite the signal lantern atop the guardhouse to call reinforcements, a precautionary measure in case of trouble. Riots had been known to happen, and with the chaos in West Stave the previous day, Nina wasn't surprised the guards were quick to call for help. It seemed they might need it. Nina knew a crew of barrel thugs when she saw one, and this seemed like a nasty lot, all of them large, thickly muscled, and heavily armed. Most of them had guns, a sure sign they were looking for more than a scuffle. The one in the lead wore a checked waistcoat across his broad chest and was swinging a chain in his hands. On his forearm, Nina could see a circular tattoo. She couldn't make out the details from this distance, but she would have bet good money that it was a lion curled into a crown. The Dime Lions. Pekka Rollins' boys. What the hell were they doing here? Nina glanced up. Inej would be putting the weevil in the second silo. Hopefully she was out of their view. Just what did Pekka's gang want? The answer came moments later. "Heard there was a heartrender hiding out in Sweet Reef," said the boy in the checked waistcoat loudly, still swinging that chain. Oh, saints, that's bad. Had the Dime Lions followed her and Inej from Black Vale? Were the others in trouble? And what if Pekka Rollins and his gang knew about the Grisha at the embassy? Some of them were violating their indentures by trying to leave the city. They could be blackmailed. Or worse. Pekka could sell them to the Shu. "You have your own problems right now, Zenik," said a voice in her head. "Stop worrying about saving the world, and save your own ass." Sometimes her inner voice could be very wise. One of the silo guards stepped forward. Rather bravely, Nina thought, given the Dime Lion's show of force. She couldn't make out their exchange. A paper with a vibrant red seal changed hands. The guard gave it to his companion to read. After a moment, he shrugged. And then, to Nina's horror, the guard stepped forward and unlocked the gate. The lantern on the roof of the guardhouse flashed again. They were calling off reinforcements. The red seal. Van X color. These were his silos. And there was no way the guards would risk opening that gate for anyone their employer hadn't sanctioned. The implications made her head spin. Could Jan Van Eck and Pekka Rollins be working together? If so, the dreg's chance of getting out of the city alive had just turned to crumbs on a cake plate. "Come on out, sweet Nina. Pekka's got work for ya." Nina saw that the chain the boy was swinging had a heavy manacle at the end. When she'd first come to Ketterdam, Pekka Rollins had offered her employment and his dubious protection. She'd chosen to sign with the dregs instead. It seemed Pekka was done abiding by contracts or the laws of the gangs. He was going to clap her in chains, maybe sell her to the Shu, or offer her up to Van Eck so that he could dose her with Perem. Nina was sheltered in the shadows of the second silo, but there was absolutely no way for her to move more than a few paces without exposing herself. She thought of the poison pill in her pocket. "Don't make us come get you, girl." The boy was gesturing for the other Dime Lions to fan out. Nina figured she had two advantages. First, the shackle at the end of that chain meant Pekka probably wanted her alive. He wouldn't want to sacrifice a valuable Grisha heartrender, so they wouldn't shoot. Second, This assembly of geniuses didn't know the Perem had disrupted her powers. She might be able to buy herself an Inej some time. Nina shook out her hair, summoned every bit of her courage, and strolled into the open. Instantly, she heard the sound of triggers cocking. "Easy now," she said, planting a hand on one hip. "I'm not going to be much good to Pekka if you plug me full of holes like the top of a salt shaker." "Well, hello, Grisha girl. You're gonna make this fun for us. Depends on your definition." "What's your name, handsome?" The boy smiled, revealing a gold tooth and a surprisingly charming dimple. "Eamon. That's a nice Kalish name. Can you home?" "Ma was Kalish. I don't speak that gibber." "Well, how about you get your friends here to relax and lower those weapons so I can teach you some new words?" "I don't think so. I know the way them heartrender powers work. Not letting you get hold of my insides." "Shame," Nina said. "Listen, Eamon, there's no need for trouble tonight. I just want to know Pekka's terms. If I'm going to cross Kaz, I need to know the pain is worth the price." "Kaz Brecker's good as dead, darling. And Pekka ain't offering no terms. You're coming with us, in chains or out." Nina raised her arms and saw the men around her stiffen, ready to fire, regardless of Pekka's orders. She turned the movement into a lazy stretch. "Eamon, you do know that before you clap me in those chains, I could turn half these gents' internal organs to goo."
"You're not fast enough."
"I'm fast enough to make sure you never," her eyes gave a meaningful slide below his belt buckle, "raise a flag on West Stave again." Now Eamon paled. "You can't do that." Nina cracked her knuckles. "Can't I?" A soft clang sounded from somewhere above them, and they all pointed their guns skyward. "Damn it, Inej, keep quiet." But when Nina looked up, her thoughts stuttered to a terrified halt. Inej was back on the wire, and she wasn't alone. For a moment, Nina thought she might be hallucinating as she watched the figure in white follow Inej onto the wire. She looked like a phantom floating in the air above them. Then she hurled something through the air. Nina caught a glint of metal. She didn't see it hit, but she saw Inej's steps falter. Inej righted herself, her posture ruthless, arms extended for balance. There had to be a way to help her. Nina reached out to the girl in white with her power, searching for her pulse, the fiber of her muscles, something she could control. But again, there was that terrible blindness, that nothingness.
"Not gonna help your friend," Eamon said.
"She can manage for herself," said Nina. Eamon smirked.
"You're not nearly as tough as we heard. Big talk, no action."
He turned to his crew. "I buy drinks all night for the first one to grab her." They didn't rush her. They weren't foolish enough for that. They advanced slowly, guns raised. Nina threw her hands up. They stopped, wary. But when nothing happened, she saw them exchange glances, a few smiles. And now they were coming faster, losing their fear, ready to take their reward. Nina risked a glance upward. Inej was still somehow keeping her balance. She seemed to be attempting to make her way back to the first silo, but she'd clearly been injured, and her walk was unsteady. The net. But it was no good to Nina alone. If she had a bit of Perem, just a taste of it, she could force these big idiots to help her. They'd obey her without thinking. Her mind reached out, grasping for something, anything. She would not just stand here helpless to be taken captive and watch Inej die, but all she felt was a great black void. There were no convenient bone shards, no dust to seize. The world that had once teemed with life, with heartbeats, breath, the rush of blood, had been stripped bare. It was all black desert, starless sky, barren earth. One of the Dime Lions rushed forward, and then they were all lunging at her, grabbing onto her arms, dragging her toward Eamon, whose face split with a grin, his dimple curving in a half moon. Nina released a howl of pure rage, thrashing like a wild animal.
She was not helpless. She refused to be. I know no fiercer warrior, powers are not. Then she felt it. There, in that black desert, a pocket of cold so deep it burned. There, past the silos, in the wedge of the canal on the way to the harbor. The sick boat piled high with bodies. A throb of recognition pulsed through her. She didn't sense heartbeats or blood flow, but she could feel something else. Something other. She thought of the bone shards, remembered the comfort she'd felt on Black Veil, surrounded by graves. Aemon tried to clap one of the shackles on her wrist. Let's put the collar on her, too, another Dime Lion shouted. She felt a hand in her hair. Her head wrenched back to expose her neck. Nina knew what she was thinking was madness, but she was out of sane choices. With all her remaining strength, she kicked hard at Aemon, breaking his grip. She threw her arms out in a wide arc, focusing this strange new awareness. And she felt the bodies on the barge rise. She clenched her fists. Come to me. The Dime Lion seized her wrists. Aemon struck her across the mouth, but she kept her fists clenched, her mind focused. This wasn't the exhilaration she'd felt on Perem. That had been heat, fire, light. This was a cold flame, one that burned low in blue. She felt the corpses rise, one after another, answering her call. Nina was conscious of hands on her, chains being lashed around her wrists. But the cold was deeper now. A fast-flowing winter river. Black rapids jagged with broken ice. Nina heard screaming, the rattle of gunfire, and then the twist of metal. The hands on her loosened, and the chains hit the cobblestones with an almost musical jangle. Nina drew her arms toward her, plunging further into the cold of the river. What the hell? Said Aemon, turning toward the guardhouse. What the hell? The Dime Lions were backing up now, mission forgotten, terror on their faces. And Nina could see exactly why. A line of people were pushing on the fence, rocking it on its posts. Some were old, some young, but all of them were beautiful. Cheeks flushed, lips rosy, hair bright with shine and moving in waves around their faces with the gentle sway of something that grew underwater. They were lovely, and they were horrible. Because while some of them bore no signs of injury, one had brown blood and vomit splashed all over her dress, another bore a puncture wound gone black with decay. Two were naked, and one had a deep, wide gash across her stomach, the plump pink skin falling forward in a flap. All of their eyes shone black, the glassy slate of winter water. Nina felt a wave of nausea overtake her. She felt strange and a little shameful, as if she was looking into a window she had no right to peek through. But she was out of options, and the truth was, she did not want to stop. She flexed her fingers. The fence crashed forward in a harsh screech of tearing metal. The Dime Lions opened fire, but the corpses kept coming, without interest or fear. It's her! Aemon screamed, stumbling backward, falling, dragging himself onto his knees as his men fled into the night. They're coming for the Grisha bitch! Bet you're wishing we had that talk now, Nina growled. But she didn't care about the Dime Lions. She looked up. Inej was still on the wire. But the girl in white was on the roof of the second silo, and was reaching for the clamp. The net, she demanded. Now! The corpses moved in a blurry burst of speed, rushing forward, then suddenly halting, as if awaiting instruction. She gathered her concentration and willed them to obey, shoving all her strength and life into their bodies. In seconds, they had the net in their hands, and they were running, so fast Nina could not track them. The high wire went slack. Inej fell. Nina screamed. Inej's body struck the net, bounced high, struck the net again. Nina ran to her. Inej! Her body lay in the center of the net, pocked by wicked silver stars, blood oozing from the wounds. Set her down, Nina commanded, and the corpses obeyed, lowering the net to the paving stones. Nina stumbled to Inej's side and went to her knees. Inej?
Inej threw her arms around Nina.
Never, ever do that again,
Nina sobbed. Annette? Said a merry voice. That seems unfair. Inej stiffened. The girl in white had reached the bottom of the second silo and was striding toward them. Nina's arms shot out, and the corpses stepped in front of her and Inej. You sure you want this fight, Snowflake? The girl narrowed her beautiful eyes.
I bested,
she said to Inej.
You know I did. You had a good night,
Inej replied, but her voice sounded weak as worn thread. The girl looked at the army of decaying bodies arrayed before her, appeared to assess her odds. She bowed.
We'll meet again, Wraith.
She turned in the direction Aemon and the rest of the Dime Lions had fled, vaulted over the remnants of the fence, and was gone. Someone likes drama, Nina said. I mean, really, who wears white to a knife fight?
Dunyasha, the white blade of something or other. She really wants to kill me, possibly everyone. Can you walk?
Inej nodded, though her face looked ashen.
Nina, are these people... are they dead?
When you put it that way, it sounds creepy.
But you didn't use...
No. No Perem. I don't know what this is.
And Grisha, even...
I don't know. Now that the fear of the ambush and Inej's fall were abating, she felt a kind of disgust. What had she just done? What had she tampered with? Nina remembered asking one of her teachers at the little palace where Grisha power came from. She'd been little more than a child then, awed by the older Grisha who came and went from the palace grounds on important missions.
Our power connects us to life in ways ordinary people can never understand,
her teacher had said.
That's why using our gift makes us stronger instead of depleting us. We are tied to the power of creation itself, the making at the heart of the world. For Corporalki, that bond is woven even more tightly because we deal in life and the taking of it.
The teacher had raised his hands, and Nina felt her pulse slow just slightly. The other students had released gasps and looked around at one another, all of them experiencing the same thing.
Do you feel that?
The teacher asked.
All your hearts, beating in shared time, bound to the rhythm of the world.
It had been the strangest sensation, the feeling of her body dissolving, as if they were not many students wriggling in their classroom chairs, but one creature, with a single heart, a single purpose. It had lasted only moments, but she'd never forgotten that sense of connection, the sudden understanding that her power would mean she was never alone. But the power she'd used tonight, it was nothing like that. It was a product of Perem, not the making at the heart of the world. It was a mistake. There would be time to worry later.
We need to get out of here, Nina said.
She helped Inej to her feet, and looked at the bodies surrounding them.
Saints, they smell awful.
Nina, what if they can hear you?
Can you hear me? She asked. But the corpses did not respond, and when she reached out to them with her power, they didn't feel alive. There was something here, though. Something that spoke to her in a way the living no longer could. She thought again of the icy river. She could still feel it around her. Around everything. But now it moved in slow eddies.
What are you going to do with them?
Asked Inej. Nina gave a helpless shrug. Put them back where they were, I suppose? She raised her hands.
Go,
she told them as clearly as she could.
Be at rest.
They moved again. A sudden flurry that brought a prayer to Inej's lips. Nina watched them fade, dim shapes in the dark. Inej gave a slight shudder, then plucked a spiked silver star from her shoulder, and let it drop to the ground with a loud plink. The bleeding seemed to have slowed, but she definitely needed bandages.
Let's go before the Stadwatch show up, she said.
Where? Nina asked as they set out for the canal. If Pekka Rollins found us... Inej's steps slowed as reality set in.
If Black Veil is compromised, Kaz told me where to go if things went sour. But...
The words hung in the air between them. Pekka Rollins entering the field meant much more than a foiled plan.
What if Black Veil was blown?
What if something had happened to Matthias? Would Pekka Rollins spare his life? Or simply shoot first and claim his bounty?
The Grisha.
What if Pekka had followed Jesper and Matthias to the embassy? What if they'd set out for the docks with the refugees and been captured? Again, she thought of the yellow pill in her pocket. She thought of Tamar's ferocious golden eyes, Zoya's imperious gaze, Jenya's teasing laugh. They had trusted her. If something had happened to them, she would never forgive herself. As Nina and Inej traced their steps back to the quay where their boat was moored, she spared one glance at the barge where the last of the corpses was lying down, shifting into place. They looked different now, their color returning to the ashy gray and mottled white that she associated with death. But maybe death wasn't just one thing.
"Where do we go?"
Nina asked. At that moment, they saw two figures racing toward them. Inej reached for her knives, and Nina raised her arms, prepared to call her strange soldiers once more. She knew it would be easier this time. Kaz and Wylan appeared in the light from a street lamp, their clothes rumpled, their hair covered in bits of plaster, and what might have been gravy. Kaz was leaning heavily on his cane, his pace unrelenting, the sharp features of his face set in determined lines.
"We'll fight our way out together,"
Inej whispered. Nina glanced from Inej to Kaz, and saw they both wore the same expression. Nina knew that look. It came after the shipwreck, when the tide moved against you and the sky had gone dark. It was the first sight of land, the hope of shelter, and even salvation, that might await you on a distant shore.
23. Wylan. I'm going to die, and there will be no one to help her, no one to even remember Maria Hendricks. Wylan wanted to be brave, but he was cold and bruised, and worse, he was surrounded by the bravest people he knew, and all of them seemed badly shaken. They made slow progress through the canals, pausing under bridges and in dark wells of shadow to wait as squads of Stadwatch boots thundered overhead or along the waterways. They were out in force tonight, their boats cruising along slowly, bright lanterns at their prows. Something had changed in the short time since the showdown on Godmed Bridge. The city had come alive, and it was angry. "The Grisha..." Nina had attempted, but Kaz had cut her off quickly. "They're either safe at the embassy or beyond our help. They can fend for themselves. We're going to ground." And then Wylan knew just how much trouble they were in, because Nina hadn't argued. She'd simply put her head in her hands and gone silent. "They'll be all right," said Inej, placing an arm around her shoulders. "He'll be all right." But her movements were tentative, and Wylan could see blood on her clothes. After that, no one spoke a word. Kaz and Roddy rowed only sporadically, steering them into the quieter, narrower canals, letting them drift silently whenever possible, until they rounded a bend near Schoenstrat, and Kaz said, "Stop." He and Roddy dug in their oars, bringing them flush with the side of the canal, tucked behind the bulk of a vendor's boat. Whatever the floating shop sold, its stalls had been locked tight to protect its stock. Up ahead, they could see Stadwatch swarming over a bridge, two of their boats obscuring the passage beneath. "They're setting up blockades," said Kaz. They ditched the boat there and continued on foot. Wylan knew they were headed to another safe house, but Kaz had said it himself. There is no safe. Where could they possibly hide? Pekka Rollins was working with Weiland's father. Between them, they had to own half the city. Weiland would be captured, and then what? No one would believe he was Jan Van Eck's son. Weiland Van Eck might be despised by his father, but he had rights no shoe criminal could hope for. Would he end up in Hellgate? Would his father find a way to see him executed? As they got farther from the manufacturing district and the barrel, the patrols dwindled, and Weiland realized the Stod Watch must be concentrating their efforts on the less respectable parts of town. Still, they moved in fits and starts, passing along alleys Weiland had never known existed, occasionally entering empty storefronts or the lower levels of unoccupied apartments so they could cut through to the next street. It was as if Kaz had a secret map to Ketterdam that showed the city's forgotten spaces. Would Jesper be waiting when they finally got wherever they were going? Or was he lying wounded and bleeding on the floor of the tomb with no one to come to his aid? Weiland refused to believe it. The worse the odds, the better Jesper was in a fight. He thought of Jesper pleading with Combe. "I know I let you down. Just give me one more chance." How often had Weiland spoken almost the same words to his father, hoping every time that he could make good on them? Jesper had to survive. They all did. Weiland remembered the first time he'd seen the sharpshooter. He'd seemed like a creature from another world, dressed in lime green and lemon yellow, his stride long and loping, as if every step was poured from a bottle with a narrow neck. On Weiland's first night in the barrel, he'd wandered from street to street, certain he was about to be robbed, teeth chattering from the cold. Finally, when his skin was turning blue and he couldn't feel his fingers, he'd summoned the courage to ask a man smoking his pipe on the front steps of a house, "Do you know where there might be rooms for rent?"
"Sign right there says vacancy," he said, gesturing across the street with his pipe. "What are you, blind?"
"Must have missed it," Weiland said. The boarding house was filthy but blessedly cheap. He'd rented a room for 10 kruger and had also paid for a hot bath. He knew he needed to save his money, but if he contracted lung fever the first night, he'd have problems beyond being short of cash. He took the little towel into the bathroom at the end of the hall and washed up quickly. Though the water was hot enough, he felt vulnerable, crouching naked in a tub with no lock on the door. He dried his clothes as best he could, but they were still damp when he put them back on. Weiland spent that night lying on a paper-thin mattress, staring at the ceiling and listening to the sounds of the rooming house around him. On the Geld Canal, the nights were so silent you could hear the water lapping against the sides of the boathouse. But here it might as well have been noon. Music flooded in through the dirty window. People were talking, laughing, slamming doors. The couple in the room above him were fighting. The couple in the room below him were definitely doing something else. Weiland touched his fingers to the bruises at his throat and thought, "I wish I could ring for tea." That was the moment he really began to panic. How much more pathetic could he be? His father had tried to have him killed. He had almost no money and was lying on a cot that reeked of the chemicals they'd used to try to rid the mattress of lice. He should be making a plan, maybe even plotting revenge, trying to gather his wits and his resources. And what was he doing? Wishing he could ring for tea. He might not have been happy at his father's house, but he'd never had to work for anything. He'd had servants, hot meals, clean clothes. Whatever it took to survive the barrel, Weiland knew he didn't have it. As he lay there, he sought some explanation for what had happened. Surely Migson and Pryor were to blame. His father hadn't known. Or maybe Migson and Pryor had misunderstood his father's orders. It had just been a terrible mistake. Weiland rose and reached into the damp pocket of his coat. His enrollment papers to the music school in Belent were still there. As soon as he drew out the thick envelope, he knew his father was guilty. It was soaked through and smelled of canal, but its color was pristine. No ink had bled through from the supposed documents inside. Weiland opened the envelope anyway. The sheaf of folded papers clung together in a wet lump, but he pried each of them apart. They were all blank. His father hadn't even bothered with a convincing ruse. He'd known Weiland wouldn't try to read the papers, and that his gullible son would never think to suspect his father of lying. Pathetic. Weiland had stayed inside for 2 days, terrified. But on the third morning, he'd been so hungry that the smell of frying potatoes wafting up from the street had driven him from the safety of his room. He bought a paper cone full of them and scarfed them down so greedily he burned his tongue. Then he made himself walk. He had only enough money to keep his room for another week, less if he planned on eating. He needed to find work, but he had no idea where to begin. He wasn't big enough or strong enough for a job in the warehouses or shipyards. The softer jobs would require him to read. Was it possible one of the gambling dens, or even one of the pleasure houses, needed a musician to play in their parlors? He still had his flute. He walked up and down East Stave and along the more well-lit side streets. When it started to get dark, he returned to the boarding house, thoroughly defeated. The man with the pipe was still on his steps, smoking. As far as Weiland knew, he never left that perch. "I'm looking for a job," Weiland said to him. "Do you know anyone who might be hiring?" The man peered at him through a cloud of smoke. "Young dollop of cream like you should be able to make fine coin on West Stave." "Honest work." The man had laughed until he started hacking, but eventually he directed Weiland south to the tanneries. Weiland was paid a scraping wage for mixing dyes and cleaning the vats. The other workers were mostly women and children, a few scrawny boys like him. They spoke little, too tired and too ill from the chemicals to do more than complete their work and collect their pay. They were given no gloves or masks, and Weiland was fairly sure he'd be dead of poisoning before he ever had to worry about where he should go with the tiny bit of money he was earning. One afternoon, Weiland heard the dye chief complaining that they were losing gallons of dye to evaporation because the boilers ran too hot. He was cursing over the cost he'd paid to have two of them fixed and how little good it had done. Weiland hesitated, then suggested adding seawater to the tanks.
"Why the hell would I want to do that?" said the dye chief.
"It will raise the boiling point," said Weiland, wondering why he'd thought it was a good idea to speak at all. "The dyes will have to get hotter to boil, so you'll lose less to evaporation. You'll have to tweak the formula because the saline will build up fast, and you'll have to clean the tanks more regularly because the salt can be corrosive." The dye chief had merely spat a stream of yurda onto the floor and ignored him. But the next week, they tried using salt water in one of the tanks. A few days later, they were using a mixture of seawater in all of them, and the dye chief started coming to Weiland with more questions. How could they keep the red dye from stiffening the hides? How could they shorten processing and drying times? Could Weiland make a resin to keep the dyes from bleeding?
A week after that, Wylan had been standing at the vats with his wooden paddle, woozy from the dyes, eyes watering, wondering if helping the dye chief meant he could request a raise, when a boy approached him. He was tall, lanky, his skin a deep, zemony brown, and looked ridiculously out of place on the dyeing floor. Not just because of his lime-plaid waistcoat and yellow trousers, but because he seemed to exude pleasure, as if there was no place he'd rather be than a miserable, foul-smelling tannery, as if he'd just walked into a party he couldn't wait to attend. Though he was skinny, his body fit together with a kind of loose-limbed ease. The dye chief didn't usually like strangers on the dyeing floor, but he didn't say a word to this boy with the revolvers slung across his hips, just tipped his hat respectfully and went scurrying off. Wyland's first thought was that this boy had the most perfectly shaped lips he'd ever seen. His second was that his father had sent someone new to kill him. He gripped his paddle. Would the boy shoot him in broad daylight? Did people just do that? But the boy said, "Here you know your way around a chemistry set." "What? Yes, a bit," Wylan had managed. "Just a bit?" Wylan had the sense that his next answer was very important. "I have a background." He'd taken to science and math and pursued them diligently, hoping they might somehow compensate for his other failings. The boy handed Wylan a folded piece of paper. "Then come to this address when you get off work tonight. We might have a job for you." He looked around, as if just noticing the vats and the pallid laborers bent over them. "A real job." Wylan had stared at the paper, the letters a tangle in front of his eyes. I don't know where this is." The boy gave an exasperated sigh. "You're not from here, are you?" Wylan shook his head. "Fine, I'll come fetch you, because clearly I don't have anything to do with my time but squire new lilies around town." "Wylan, right?" Wylan nodded. "Wylan what?" "Wylan Hendricks." "You know much about demo? Wylan Hendricks?" "Demo? The boom, the bang, the flint and fuss." Wylan didn't know what he meant at all, but he felt admitting that would be a bad mistake. "Sure," he said, with as much confidence as he could muster. The boy cut him a skeptical glance. "We'll see. Be out front at 6 bells, and no guns, unless you want trouble." "Of course not." The boy had rolled his gray eyes and muttered, "Kaz has got to be out of his mind." At 6 bells, Jesper arrived to escort Wylan to a bait shop in the barrel. Wylan had been embarrassed by his rumpled clothes, but they were the only ones he owned, and the paralyzing fear that this was just some elaborate trap concocted by his father had provided ample distraction from his worry. In a back room of the bait shop, Wylan met Kaz and Inej. They told him they needed flash bombs and maybe something with a little more kick. Wylan had refused. That night, he arrived back at the boarding house to find the first letter. The only words he recognized were the name of the sender, Jan Van Eck. He'd lain awake all night, certain that at any moment Pryor would smash through the door and clamp his meaty hands around his neck. He'd thought about running, but he barely had enough money to pay his rent, let alone buy a ticket out of the city. And what hope did he have in the country? No one was going to hire him on as farm labor. The next day, he went to see Kaz, and that night he built his first explosive for the dregs. He knew what he was doing was illegal, but he'd made more money for a few hours' work than he made in a week at the tannery. The letters from his father continued to arrive, once, sometimes twice a week. Weiland didn't know what to make of them. Were they threats? Taunts? He stashed them in a stack beneath his mattress, and sometimes at night he thought he could feel the ink bleeding through the pages, up through the mattress, and into his heart, like dark poison. But the more time that passed, and the more he worked for Kaz, the less scared he felt. He'd make his money, get out of town, and never speak the name Van Eck again. And if his father decided to have him done away with before then, there was nothing Weiland could do about it. His clothes were ragged and threadbare. He was getting so skinny he had to cut new holes in his belt. But he would sell himself in the pleasure houses of West Stave before he'd ask for his father's mercy. Weiland hadn't realized it then, but Kaz had known his true identity all along. Dirty Hands kept tabs on anyone who took up residence in the barrel, and he'd placed Weiland under Dreg's protection, certain that one day a rich mercher's son would come in handy. He had no illusions about why Kaz had looked out for him, but he also knew he never would have survived this long without his help. And Kaz didn't care if he could read. Kaz and the others teased him, but they'd given him a chance to prove himself. They valued the things he could do instead of punishing him for the things he couldn't. Weiland had believed that Kaz could get revenge for what had been done to his mother. He'd believed that despite his father's wealth and influence, this crew, his crew, was a match for Jan Van Eck. But now his father was reaching out to taunt him yet again.
It was well past midnight when they reached the financial district. They'd arrived in one of the wealthiest areas of the city, not far from the Exchange and the Stadthall. His father's presence felt closer here, and Weiland wondered why Kaz had brought them to this part of town. Kaz led them through an alley to the back of a large building where a door had been propped open, and they entered a stairwell built around a huge iron lift that they shuffled inside. Roddy remained behind, presumably to keep watch over the entrance. The lift's gate clanged shut, and they rode it 15 stories up to the building's top floor, then emerged into a hallway laid in patterns of lacquered hardwood, its high ceilings painted a pale, foamy lavender. "We're in a hotel," Weiland realized. That was the servants' entrance and the staff elevator. They knocked on a pair of wide, white double doors. Colm Fahey answered, wearing a long nightshirt with a coat thrown over it. They were at the Geldrenner. "The others are inside," he said wearily. Colm asked them no questions, just pointed toward the bathroom and poured himself a cup of tea as they tracked mud and misery across the purple carpets. When Matthias saw Nina, he leapt from his seat on the huge aubergine sofa and clasped her in his arms. "We couldn't get through the blockades to Sweet Reef," he said. "I feared the worst." Then they were all hugging, and Weiland was horrified to find his eyes filling with tears. He blinked them back. The last thing he needed was for Jesper to see him cry again. The sharpshooter was covered in soot and smelled like a forest fire, but he had that wonderful glimmer-eyed look he always seemed to get when he'd been in a fight. All Weiland wanted to do was stand as close as he possibly could to him and know that he was safe. Until this moment, Weiland hadn't quite understood how much they meant to him. His father would have sneered at these thugs and thieves, a disgraced soldier, a gambler who couldn't keep out of the red. But they were his first friends, his only friends, and Weiland knew that even if he'd had his pick of 1,000 companions, these would have been the people he chose. Only Kaz stood apart, staring silently out the window to the dark streets below.
"Kaz," said Nina, "you may not be glad we're alive, but we're glad you're alive. Come here."
"Leave him be," murmured Inej softly.
"Saints, Wraith," said Jesper, "you're bleeding."
"Should I call a doctor?" asked Jesper's father.
"No,